Welcome to Music History Monday for July 6th, 2020. My name is Bob Greenberg, and the title for today's podcast is Pops, the Indispensable Man. We mark the death on July 6th, 1971, 49 years ago today, of the jazz trumpet player, singer, bandleader, and American icon, Louis Armstrong. For our information, Armstrong pronounced his first name as Louis, as shall we. Known alternately as Louis, Satchmo, Satch, or simply Pops, Armstrong was the indispensable man of jazz. One brief but I think most worthy item of date-appropriate business to mention before moving on to Maestro Armstrong, an event that occurred on this date in 1957, 63 years ago today. That was the day that Paul McCartney and John Lennon met for the first time. Background. In November of 1956, two high school students, John Lennon, 1940 to 1980, and his friend, the guitarist and later dry cleaner, Eric Griffiths, 1940 to 2005, founded a band in their hometown of Liverpool. They initially called the band the Blackjacks, but quarryman renamed it the Quarrymen in honor of their high school, Quarry Bank High School. By early 1957, the band numbered six members. Lennon designed a poster that was put up across Liverpool, which informed its readers that, quote, country and western, rock and roll, skiffle band, the Quarrymen, open for engagements, unquote. On July 6th, 1957, the band was engaged to play at the St. Peter's Church Rose Queen Garden Festival in the high-end Liverpool suburb of Wootton. At 4:15 p.m., they began a set on a stage set up behind the church. It was during this set that Paul McCartney, born 1942, arrived to hear the Quarrymen play. When the band had finished playing, McCartney was introduced to John Lennon. Eager to show Lennon what he could do, McCartney picked up a guitar and played and sang Eddie Cochran's 20 Flight Rock, Gene Vincent's Bebop Alula, and a medley of songs by Little Richard. Lennon was indeed impressed, even more so when McCartney showed Lennon and Eric Griffiths how to tune their guitars, something they'd actually been paying someone else to do for them. 2 weeks later, Lennon invited McCartney to join the band, which he did. In 1958, thanks to McCartney's advocacy, his schoolmate, George Harrison, 1943 to 2001, who knew, by the way, how to tune a guitar, was incorporated into the band. In 1960, the group changed its name to the Beatles. Ringo Starr, born 1940, became the Beatles drummer in August of 1962, and the rest, well, the rest is indeed music history. Indispensability. Can any single individual be said to be indispensable? I know, for some folks it's a specious, borderline useless question on the lines of, does anybody really know what time it is? So indulge me. It is trite to the point of cliche to say that no one is indispensable, that history is the product of the interaction of innumerable complex events that go far beyond anything a single person could definitively influence. Franz Kafka, 1883 to 1924, writes in The Metamorphosis that, quote, no one is indispensable, and the world can carry on without you, maybe in a better way, unquote. Charles de Gaulle, 1890 to 1970, undoubtedly believing that he was to be the exception, famously pointed out that, quote, the graveyards are full of indispensable men, unquote, opined Pittsburgh Steelers head coach Chuck Knoll, 1932 to 2014, quote, "Everyone's job is important, but no one is indispensable," unquote. And blah, blah, blah. At the other end of the spectrum is such self-esteem-driven, feel-good, I'm-okay, you're-okay, pop psychology drivel, like the following from the motivational speaker Josh Allen Dykstra, quote, "The truth is, everyone is indispensable. No one thinks like you. No one has your background. No one has had the experiences you've had. No one has your unique talents. There's no one like you, which means there's exactly no one who can do something exactly like you can," unquote. Oh, please. Such TED Talk twaddle gives the whole concept of the indispensable person a bad name. Back in the mid-1980s, I read a biography of George Washington by the superb Pulitzer Prize-winning American historian Thomas Flexner, 1908 to 2003, entitled Washington, The Indispensable Man, published by Plume. The title was controversial when the book was first published in 1969, and I suppose it remains so to this day for anyone who does not believe that an individual can be indispensable. But Flexner easily makes his case, as do later biographies by Edward Lengel, General George Washington, A Military Life, Random House, 2005, and Ron Chernow, Washington, A Life, Penguin Press, 2010. That case? Without Washington's military leadership and the truest of grit, the American Revolution would certainly have failed. And without Washington's political leadership and selflessness, the young American democracy would almost certainly have failed as well. Provided one accepts the concept of an indispensable person, each of us could make our own list of such people. While our lists would be different, the common link between all of our candidates would be that they each embodied a focal point, that they would each constitute the right person at the right place at the right time. Whether we're talking about Beethoven, or Lincoln, or Gandhi, or Churchill, or Mandela, apologies that these are all men, we're talking about people shaped by their times and places who, through the force of their will and genius, come to embody the best angels of their times, people whose empathy, creativity, and courage elevated humanity to a better place than it could have gone without them. In the world of jazz, that indispensable person was Louis Armstrong, August 4th, 1901, to July 6th, 1971. Louis Armstrong did not invent jazz, although it was still in its infancy when the 11-year-old Armstrong first hefted a cornet. Neither was he the first outstanding jazz cornet slash trumpet player. That honor must go to his mentor, Joseph Nathan King Oliver, 1881 to 1938. What Louis Armstrong did was demonstrate that jazz was capable of being more than mere entertainment or folk music, but rather high art. In his seminal book, Early Jazz, Its Roots and Musical Development, Oxford, 1968, the composer, conductor, and scholar Gunther Schuller observes that by the late 1920s, Louis Armstrong, quote, served notice that jazz had the potential capacity to compete with the highest order of previously known musical expression. Though nurtured by the crass entertainment and nightclub world of the Prohibition era, Armstrong's music transcended this context and its implications. This was music for music's sake. Not the first time in jazz, but never before in such a brilliant and unequivocal form. The beauties of his music were those of any great, compelling musical experience. Expressive fervor, intense artistic commitment, and an intuitive sense for structural logic combined with superior instrumental skill. By whatever definition of art, be it abstract, sophisticated, virtuosic, emotionally expressive, structurally perfect, Armstrong's music qualified, unquote. It was Armstrong whose recordings, touring, and utterly joyful, all-embracing personality established jazz as an international phenomenon in the 1920s and 1930s, just as Elvis Presley made rock and roll an international phenomenon in the 1950s. Armstrong was and remains the single most influential jazz musician of all time. Miles Davis, 1926 to 1991, who rarely said anything nice about anybody, said that it was impossible to play anything on a horn that Armstrong hadn't already played. According to Wynton Marsalis, born 1962, Armstrong is, quote, the foundation of our grammar, the syntax of our playing, unquote. Dizzy Gillespie, 1917 to 1993, put it this way, quote, his style was equally copied by saxophonists, trumpet players, pianists, and all of the instrumentalists who make up the jazz picture, unquote. The Diz speaks the truth. When Armstrong died, the brilliant pianist and longtime Armstrong collaborator Earl Hines, 1903 to 1983, who for decades credited his piano style to Armstrong's trumpet style, said, quote, we were almost like brothers. I'm so heartbroken over this. The world has lost a champion, unquote. In 1971, the New York Times jazz critic John S. Wilson wrote that Armstrong was, quote, the root source that moved jazz onto the path along which it has developed now for more than 45 years, unquote. When by the 1960s, a lifetime of playing his cornet and trumpet had taken its toll on his chops, Armstrong turned evermore to singing in his inimitable voice, an instrument in its own right, which has been compared to iron filings and, quote, a piece of sandpaper calling to its mate, unquote. His cover of Hello, Dolly ended the Beatles' streak of 3 number one hits in a row over 14 consecutive weeks when it was released in 1964. His 1967 recording of What a Wonderful World remains one of the best-selling recordings of all time. Albin Krebs, writing in Armstrong's obituary in the New York Times in 1971, waxed lyric, quote, just watching an Armstrong performance was an exhilarating experience. The man radiated a jollity that was infectious. On stage, he would bend back his stocky frame, point his trumpet to the heavens, and joyfully blast out high C's. When he sang, he fairly bubbled with pleasure, and as he swabbed away at the perspiration stirred up by his performing exertions, Satchmo grinned his famous toothy smile so incandescently that it seemed to light up the auditorium, unquote. Which brings up the oft-asked question. Was Louis Armstrong the single most important jazz musician in history? Or the world's most beloved entertainer? The answer? Yes. Tomorrow's Dr. Bob Prescribes post, which can be found at patreon.com/Robert Greenberg Music, will offer up a brief outline of Armstrong's life, an appraisal of his playing style that addresses the nuts and bolts of his singular greatness, and finally, two recommended discs without which you can no longer live. Until then, thank you.